The views expressed on this podcast are only those of the individuals featured on the show and do not in any way reflect the official policy of the United States government.
You are listening to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. We believe wealth isn't just about finances and money. It includes health, relationships, and anything else that makes you excited to get up in the morning. We interview members of the foreign affairs community to see how they're building wealth, both personally and financially, no matter where they're posted. This is your host, Tanya Salsa. Let's get to today's show. Welcome to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. We are here today with Nafisa Allen. Nafisa is originally from Newark, New Jersey, which she describes as a very diverse and extremely segregated place in some ways. And that has shaped not only her foreign service life, but also her investment strategies as she's gone forward. She's gone from New Jersey to Boston to New York, and then landed in DC as a young foreign service officer, and immediately for her first assignment had to navigate the waters of the DC real estate market right away. Since then, she's been on the Pakistan desk, she's been to India, Mozambique, Angola, and is now joining us from Peru. Welcome to the show, Nafisa.
Thank you so much for having me, Tanya.
So tell us a little bit about your investment story.
Sure. Yeah, like you mentioned, I'm originally from Newark, New Jersey, which is a city that is fraught with all types of stories about real estate and segregation and discrimination and all sorts of things, as well as, you know, lots of other very feel-good stories of, you know, artists and you know, inventors. And it's a very mixed bag of narratives that people have about that city. But I think as it relates to my wealth journey, it's a city of redlining. I learned about it probably in college or graduate school, where there's a lot of communities of color that just were never able to either own their properties or upgrade their properties because of a very deliberate process of redlining. And I think as I learned more about that, and I learned more about the ways that the city sort of is shaped now as a result of that, I think it really has been a huge part of the way that I invest in the types of communities that I want to invest in. So when I finally joined the Foreign Service, my first assignment, like you said, was in Washington. And, you know, you're in A100 and everybody tells you, oh my gosh, we're going to take care of you. You have free housing. You're going to live abroad. It'll be so great. And then on Flag Day, I get DC and I'm like, oh my God, where am I going to live? I'm not from DC. I don't have any place to stay. And so at the time I was dating somebody and basically was like, hey, I'm living with you now. And that was not sustainable. So soon thereafter, probably like 3 months or so into that tour, I was like, I got to find a place of my own and started looking in the DC market. And it felt very similar to Newark in a lot of ways where, you know, just this was 2009. So it just felt like these were communities that I really related to, that I kind of understood, especially in places where I was looking, which was sort of northwest, north of Howard. I mean, I think that's kind of how it started, out of that necessity. And I learned quite a bit about the DC market very quickly because I was looking super quickly. And then I think after going to India, I just thought, hey, you know, I would like to continue to grow that portfolio. I'd like to continue to grow real estate. And that was a whole other reason why. But a lot of that was because I really didn't want to get into sort of lifestyle creep that I had seen in India, where people kind of went and bought jewelry because they had a rough day or a rough week. And I just thought, maybe if I save up my money, I can, you know, have sort of a property portfolio that's kind of reflects what I didn't spend on those assignments. And so I kind of just got into this habit of buying a property after every assignment and trying to build my portfolio that way. I hope that's a good, concise summary. The idea is basically the loan market is structured such that you or communities are not able to get loans to do things as homeowners, such that then they're either not able to keep up with, you know, relevant codes or relevant conditions of their property. And then either they lose those properties or it just drives down the value of their market. Essentially, throughout the 60s, I guess around the same time as the Newark riots, which was 67, the banks basically said there was a central ward was not going to be an area that they would agree to fund. So any homeowner in that area, basically, if you didn't have cash, you couldn't do any capital repairs to your property, right? If you need to do some major renovation, the way that we can kind of tap into HELOCs or refis or, you know, and get some money out just to take care of those things, that wasn't available. And that neighborhood was predominantly Black. And Newark has a very diverse history, but like I said, it's very segregated. So there's certain parts of town that were for the Irish and the Italians, certain parts of town that were for Brazilians and Portuguese, and other parts of town that were for these sort of great migration transplants, which is from my family, and that's predominantly Black. And so in those areas, there was just a lot of limitation about whether or not we could own properties of similar value to those other neighborhoods, or the ways that we could upgrade our properties or not. And it's very striking. Like, even if you go to Newark today, you'll see, if you go to certain parts of it, if you go to North, like the Ironbound section, you'll be like, is this the same city as the Central Ward? And it's just because there've been so many historical reasons for that. It's not just because people don't like taking care of their property, or they, you know, don't care about their community. It's because, you know, those, that generational, intergenerational wealth that most people pass down family to family was something Black families really couldn't hold on to. I can look into it a little bit more beyond Newark, and I'm sure there are other places where this has happened all across America. But I think when it comes to thinking about how I look at communities now, I look at like different communities where I see that happening. I invested in Johannesburg, for example, which has a very similar history. There's, and it wasn't for the same reasons, actually. The redlining in Johannesburg happened because there were communities where people were resisting apartheid. So Blacks and whites lived together. And that was completely illegal at the time. And the government basically said, okay, fine, well, we're going to punish you, right? We're not going to provide services to your area. We're not going to let you do any improvements. And the idea was basically they would be sort of coerced into the apartheid system. I think of the places that I have really gotten attached to have a really similar story to my hometown. And it's unfortunate that that's what happened, but I think that's definitely part of my investing philosophy.
I love that you have this very personal story and reason actually for investing that the way that you do, right? Because we all come from a certain background, and you've managed to combine kind of your values and your philosophy in what you invest in, right? I think that's amazing. And I'm actually curious, because you started out in the US, right? And then you also have property in foreign countries. So you said, you mentioned the property in South Africa. I believe you also have property in Angola. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? And, you know, a lot of the overseas embassy community is interested in purchasing in foreign countries, but it seems very daunting, right? The rules and regulations are different than the United States. Share with us some of your experiences about purchasing in other countries.
Yeah, so I don't own in Angola. My husband owns property in Mozambique, and he's a Mozambican citizen, so that made sense. I think in terms of buying abroad, I guess it's worth explaining. For every tour that I did, you know, as much as I collected property along the way, I also collected degrees. So I did a master's when I was in India. I did a PhD when I was in Mozambique, but I did my PhD in South Africa at a South African university. So my introduction to Johannesburg wasn't on a tour officially. It was kind of going back and forth from Mozambique because I was going to university. And originally it was like, hey, we're here so often, you know, let's look into buying property that in a place where we end up going all the time, because I was there maybe every 3 or 4 months, and it just felt like I love the city. I love the vibe. I love the history of Johannesburg. For me, it's kind of like a New York City in Africa in a way. And so my husband was like, well, let's just look into it. And then we learned more about it. So I guess what I would say for Foreign Service people who are interested in buying property, you know, like I think there's a lot of fear about, you know, oh my gosh, what's going to happen to my security clearance? Or, oh my gosh, you know, it's going to be one more thing to explain on my, you know, fiscal report every year. And I guess, you know, like that's true, right? Like, yes, you will have to explain your investments the same way you should have to explain any investment, I guess, you know, foreign or domestic, when those reporting cycles come around, but I don't think people should be daunted by thinking that, you know, if you buy abroad, it's going to automatically be harder for you to work or harder for you to do anything. I mean, my experience was, it was very transparent. South Africa is a very easy place to invest. They have lots of American and foreign investors. They're not new to this. So, you know, I was freaked out more than they were. Like I didn't hire a lawyer, but I talked to a lawyer like, oh my God, like, how is this going to work? And they were like, dude, we have laws for this. This is like how the real estate market works. There's a lot of foreign investors. You're not the first, you're not going to be the last. So I think just talking to people who are already in that market and understanding like that they had had a lot of sinking, I guess, with our banking system. For example, like we bought a property off plan. It was a condo off plan. And, you know, they had us file all the IRS documents basically saying, hey, we've got a foreign bank account. And they reported that to the IRS, which gave us a lot of confidence that we didn't have to do all this extra work in our tax preparation to explain why we've got money in this other place. So there's a lot of places like that. I think Europe is generally American investor friendly as well. And so there's a lot of those things that are done for you. So it's not as complicated as you might think. For my husband buying in Mozambique at the time when he purchased, he wasn't an American citizen. And it was, you know, he basically bought land there because that's, you know, that's what you do in Mozambique, because you don't buy a house that's already built. You buy land and you build your house basically sort of brick by brick. And that's what he's been doing. And so obviously as a couple, you know, I help him out. We work together on whatever it is that he's thinking, but his projects look very different from mine. Like his, you know, he's got a whole construction site and I am very, you know, move-in ready kind of girl. I envy folks who can manage their properties themselves. I'm sure there's so much more money you take home and a lot more knowledge that you gather about, you know, the ins and out of your property when you manage it yourself. But I have not managed any of my properties myself. And frankly, that's how I manage it. I thankfully had, again, through my connections at university, one of my really good friends, her husband is a real estate broker and also a property manager. And when I heard that, I was like, okay, we're done here. Like, you are it. Please take care of everything. And so that's how South Africa kind of came together, because I felt like I had a trustworthy team there. And I think that's true in every place I've invested. It's really making sure that I have a team that I trust, that is transparent, that gets me the types of information that I need to know to feel confident, not just in the numbers, because that's a huge part of it, but also just in the upkeep of the property. So one of the things that Tanya and I have always talked about is how I've really struggled with this idea of being sort of either a gentrifier or a slumlord, right? I think there's a lot of people who talk about properties in low-income neighborhoods or predominantly Black neighborhoods in that way. And I think part of why I have a property manager is because I never want to be associated with either of those monikers, right? I want to be very clear that I'm trying to create affordable housing in these places that traditionally haven't necessarily had it. And I'd like to make sure that those properties are high quality, high value. And in my mind, I have to have a property manager to do that, who can go visit and, you know, check up on things and make sure there's no leaky faucets and, you know, all those things. And so lots of property managers. That's how I've managed. I think it's important for, I guess, people who are thinking about my story, I didn't start as an investor in my own mind, right? I started as sort of a community builder. Like, I think there's a lot of folks who are sort of into, now it's very popular, this like buy back the block type of mentality. And I feel like when I started in 2009, I had that mentality, but really didn't have the vocabulary to explain it. So I think for a very long time, I didn't crunch my numbers. I didn't really think, you know, well, how much is this making me, or how much is it costing me to own in this neighborhood where, you know, I can foresee that in the coming future, you know, this neighborhood won't look like what it looked like 10 years ago. And so I think for a long time, I didn't look at the numbers, and I don't advise that. But I think I was lucky in the sense that I put a lot of focus into the acquisition itself, right? Like I am very, and Tanya knows this because I bought property with Tanya and she's seen me go like, no, it's got to be $50,000 less. And she's like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, yes, that's the only way the numbers work. 50,000. She's like, they're never going to do that. I'm like, try it, see what they say. So I think I really am very heavy on the upfront. What are the numbers when I purchase this property? And for the most part, when I was very early on in my career, I was like, I had this $200,000 wall. I was like, I'm not buying anything over 200. If I go over 200 on the purchase price, the numbers really don't shake out in terms of the rental market. And that's for the US, not for South Africa. South Africa is a whole different set of numbers. But yeah, so I mean, that was kind of my cap in my mind. And frankly, it has worked very well. It has served me very well. But for like the DC market and in New Jersey, where I'm originally from, where I purchased property too, I think over time, I've had to get more sophisticated about that, right? I've recently purchased in Baltimore, where your numbers like 200 doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. Like there's sort of I've had a 100 cap, I've had a $500,000 cap, right? It kind of just depends on the neighborhood and in the area. So I've focused really heavily on that. The other place where I found that I can get a lot of value is in my property management, and not necessarily in their fees, but in how they manage the maintenance and the contracting that goes into that. So I have, you know, hired and fired many property managers, and I think that's probably a healthy way to do it, that you work with them until they, you know, for as long as they serve you and they serve the property. But if that doesn't, that balance doesn't work anymore, then you've got to move on. So I've tried to keep low property management fees, but also just with property managers who are just on top of it, right? Very proactive. We're not going to call, you know, the highest end remodeler to fix a plumbing problem, right? And when I felt like people were kind of price gouging in that way, I've definitely moved on, or I found my own contractor and asked the property manager to work directly with that person. So keeping those maintenance costs low has been a huge part of that. And then also just, you know, rewarding good renters, right? Like if you get a good renter, you don't have to, the benefit of the foreign service, right? It's like we get a steady paycheck. So I don't have to make huge margins every year off of, you know, jacking up my rent. Like if I keep them on board, we keep maintenance costs low, they take good care of the property, you know, I want to keep them there as long as possible. So, you know, I work with them on making sure that we're not increasing the rent so much so that they're going to have to move out, which, you know, has its own costs. So I think it's a lot of different things, but I'm very heavy on the acquisition numbers.
Nafisa, I'm curious. So you and I talk quite a bit, and I know that you recently sold something in DC and did a 1031 tax exchange to buy multifamily in Baltimore. And I find that when I talk to a lot of foreign service investors or people who are interested in investing that have property already in the DC market, for example, there is this resistance to selling their initial property to trade up to something that might make them more money, right? Like either they're afraid that they are not going to be able to buy in DC again because the prices are too high. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey in terms of selling your condo in DC and investing in multifamily in Baltimore and kind of what that mental process looks like? And looking back, are you glad you did it? Do you have regrets? Mm-hmm. Because I think this is something that comes up a lot in our community.
Sure. Well, I think when you and I first started talking about that property and making that change, I feel like it was a huge trigger for me to think of myself as an investor. So that was, what is that now? About a year ago that we sort of began talking about selling off that property. So I had it was the second property that I'd ever purchased. It was in Tacoma Park. It was a condo. And I had had a steady renter I had probably never had a vacancy longer than a week in that property. And COVID hit and I started to look at the numbers and thought, well, you know, it's appreciated quite a bit. My rent hasn't gone up very much. And I kept getting, you know, really silly emails and calls, I guess, from the corporate body of the condo basically saying, you know, oh, just a lot of really little things. I mean, I think even just the general meeting of all the owners was like twice a month with like quorums. I was just like, dude, I'm not really interested in this anymore. Like the idea of having this property is a lot cooler than actually owning it. And so I felt like I was kind of getting tired of that property generally and felt like I could probably move on. And I think talking with you, you helped me figure out that there is a way to do that with and do it responsibly, right? So I felt like I had already purchased a property in Baltimore and was really curious about thinking about different properties in Baltimore. And you helped me see that, you know, if I were to let go of this one, I definitely would have, you know, an upward trajectory for earning that is really different than this property, because I kept paying condo fees and there was special assessments and there were just all of these added things that made, again, that original acquisition not make sense, right? So when I purchased it, it made total sense. The numbers worked out, but over the course of time, it started to just like add up and didn't feel like I was coming out ahead. So the 1031 process really helped me keep, you know, the tax issue sort of separate from the investing issue, right? If I had to think, oh my gosh, well, I'm going to pay taxes on all of this, I think I probably would have been deterred from moving forward. But the property had accumulated more or less, I mean, I guess about $100,000 in value from when I had purchased it, which was maybe like 7 or 8 years ago. And that put me in a really good market for Baltimore. It put me in a place to buy something that was in a very stable area and growing. And it felt like the affordability of that area was also still on par with what I had sought in this neighborhood 10 years ago. So it just felt like, you know, it was still in line with my buying philosophy. It was just a new city and a new type of property for me. So I guess as foreign service folks kind of think like letting go of your original property, I think you have to think about whether or not that original property is still serving the original purpose. So either your purpose has changed or that original purpose perhaps is not served by this neighborhood anymore. If you're kind of thinking in those terms, I kind of felt like the neighborhood had changed quite a bit. It really wasn't that affordable generally. And I felt like given all the fees that were getting tacked on to me, I was paying for that affordability for my renter. Whereas I felt like moving to Baltimore and the neighborhood that I chose to be in, I felt like I could give people value, but I didn't have to take this huge financial burden and the administrative burden, frankly, of keeping that balance for both me and the renter. So it made a lot of sense for me to just go ahead and make that move. But that said, I have two properties in DC. So people will say, oh, well, how about you sell your other one? And I'm like, no, because I think I still hold on to what you said, Tanya. Like, I still want to have like a foothold in DC. And I do very much fear the same reality that other people do, that, you know, you could, you know, sell and never be able to buy back in. But I think because I had two, it made sense to let go of one and see where that took me elsewhere. It's funny, like everybody's interested in Baltimore now. I was looking at Baltimore like a decade ago and like felt like even buying like what a year ago, I was like, man, I'm too late. And I feel like now people are like, so where about Baltimore? I'm like, you aren't in yet. So I've always loved Baltimore, again, sort of in that philosophy of communities that have already always really been close to my heart and close to my experience. Like my family always took me there. We always went to Baltimore to like the Blacks and Wax Museum. So I feel like I had already had an affinity for the city by the time I started thinking about investing in it. But we really gave it serious consideration for a variety of reasons. First, I think Baltimore has both sort of a high and low price point in terms of like what you're looking for. So originally I purchased a single family home and I was like, listen, I can get in here on a single family home under $100,000 and be looking at rents above $1,000, right? So that 1% rule for me is golden. Like I am all about, you know, trying to hit the 1% rule just off of the simple cost of the property in terms of rental. And so I was like, wow, Baltimore does that and DC does not. Like I can't even tell you where you could buy a property and get 1% you know, in your monthly rental. So Baltimore definitely like screamed, hey, there's value here. But I think also as I spent more time getting to know Baltimore, I felt like it made sense with my purchasing philosophy, right? Like there's a lot of people, hardworking people who are sort of in slummy kind of properties, right? Like they're paying their rent just fine, but their, you know, landlord perhaps is not taking the type of care that you would get out of a landlord in DC, frankly. And I felt like I could add value to the neighborhoods that I was looking at without losing money on my side, just because the purchase prices were so pretty low at the time that I purchased the single family home. Like multis are a completely different thing. And there's other parts of Baltimore where you can get a single family home that's, you know, $500,000. And I mean, you know, really astronomical in terms of value. But I think people really have to consider whether or not they're thinking about buying as a homeowner for themselves, or they're really looking as an investor. So if you're buying for yourself and you have to think, well, I could live in this, I think for most foreign service people, that's not realistic. I don't think everybody wants to do an hour commute from Baltimore every single day. And I think DC folk in our community aren't even really DC folk. It's a lot of Northern Virginia folk, right? Which is still very, you know, suburby, and it's not really like urban grit and, you know, having to deal with all of the city life. I don't feel like a lot of people have that disposition. So I think you have to be honest about that. If that's not the neighborhood you want to wake up in on a Saturday morning, that frankly isn't the place I suggest buying your property. But if you're thinking about it as an investor, where you're looking at it like you don't have to live in it, right? It's not for you to live in it. It's for the person who is going to be happy waking up there on a Saturday morning. Could you buy the property and provide them with quality, you know, housing and make money on having purchased the house and getting the rent and all of that other stuff? So I think it's foreign service people often conflate those two. I think we buy thinking, oh, I could live here. And in my experience, you have to really do that work to separate if you want to think about Baltimore or, you know, even Frederick, right? Like some people look Frederick, Hagerstown, right? These like hour outside of DC places. Sometimes you have to think, I don't want to live here, but I do think I could add value to this neighborhood as an investor.
So switching gears a little bit, I mean, you have this amazing real estate portfolio that you've built in the United States and, you know, abroad, and you also have a lot that you do beyond, you know, the foreign service and your real estate investing. So I know, for example, that you write and you were recently a published author in Real Simple, which is a huge magazine, right? And your writing career's really taken off. And you're also a mom of like two little kids, which as a fellow mom with toddlers, I mean, that is a really hard thing. And you're at this part of your life where you're really in sort of expansion and building and creation mode and trying to balance all of these things. Like, how do you do it? Like, do you have any tips or advice for other women in your position, like thinking about similar things?
Sure. I think all this came together both through necessity and through, I think when you're creative at heart, you can't turn it off, right? I feel like I've always been a writer, even since I was really young, a writer and artist. And I thought, you know, I'd put on a suit and I'd go out there and I'd, you know, diplomacy it up, and that would feel fulfilling. I think I like a lot of the things that we do, and I like a lot of the ways that I can engage, and I like being so close to the communities that I find intellectually interesting. But let's not make it sound like doing a consular tour for 2 or 3 years is like your heart's dream, right? So I feel like I came to a point where I was like, you don't have to love every minute of everything about a career, right? You've got all the time after 5 p.m., right, to try all these other things. And you don't have to turn off all those other passions. And you don't have to sort of dull or flatten yourself to identify yourself as a career. And I think COVID really pushed me into that. And my tour in Angola, I think I just had a lot of tension around being a mom and being the type of mom that I want to be and having the autonomy to make decisions for myself and decisions for my family that I felt were authentic and realistic and very gratifying for us. But having that constantly run up against people's expectations of what I should do in my role and being on 24-hour duty and all of these other things. And so I think I had been doing a lot of this, even real estate, kind of as a hobbyist for many years. It was just sort of like, oh, this is exciting to do while I'm doing this career. But I think especially when I had my daughter about 2 years ago, that whole process really made me think, who am I? And am I really digging into all the gifts that I have and giving the world everything that I have, or am I kind of hiding behind this career? And so I decided that I wouldn't be hiding anymore. And, you know, to be the type of mom and the person that I want them to be proud of, I've got to show up 100% in all of the places where I have gifts and all of the places where I have opportunities and all the places where I have talents. And so I really dug into the writing part of it. And yeah, so Real Simple happened earlier this month, and I'm doing a couple more pieces for them and the brand that they're under. It started a lot from my academic writing, because I was able to really start to publish in journals around the type of research that I was finding. Oh yeah, I remember this, right? Like in college, I used to do this all the time. I pitched articles, and why am I not doing that? Why do I feel like I can't do that and, you know, and be a diplomat or and be a mom? And so time-wise, I think it's difficult to manage. And I have an amazing husband who is extremely forgiving. So there's a value to that. You know, childcare is essential. There's no part of me that denies the value of having, you know, trustworthy, reliable childcare. I wouldn't be able to do any of this if it weren't for the people in my life who love my kids as much as I do. And I got a lot of productivity tips out of my human resources assignment. So I learned a lot about productivity hacks and different ways to sort of make my computer system send auto messages and things that save time and things that just organize my life so that I could really show up a lot better in all of those different facets. So long story short, I think I just have a lot of help, and I have a lot of systems that help me to be able to be in a lot of different places and still show up my best. When we join the Foreign Service, people always say, you know, how do you pass the test, right? And I'm like, dude, like 12th grade history, right? The way, like, go get a 12th grade history book, right? And take a look at it and like absorb it. That's pretty much, you know, what people expect you to know. Aside from essays and all that other stuff, sort of pop culture and Americana, when it all boils down to it, it's knowing that baseline understanding that all Americans are taught and are expected to understand, are expected to believe, and to know that, right? Even if you can test certain parts of it or think that, hey, this didn't go this way, you still have to know the narrative. So I felt like showing up in a country and not knowing that narrative for that country was doing a disservice both to me and Americans and the ways that we show up in diplomacy and to the communities that I was hoping to sort of help and serve in those countries. And so it kind of started with that sort of being like, if I think this is a baseline for diplomacy and, you know, for America, why would this not be a baseline of diplomacy for the countries that I'm in? And, you know, and I think through that, I started to realize how much the stories we tell about these places are so different from the stories they tell themselves, right? Or they teach each other. And so I got really curious about that. And it builds on my master's work. So a lot of my master's work was on Brazil, and it was looking at the ways that race versus social policy show up and whether or not they're actually effective for the communities that they target, and whether or not cultural pride sort of philosophy is any more effective than saying, hey, we're just going to do direct transfers to communities that meet a particular demographic. And so I was really curious about how that functions, right? This sort of politicization of identity, how that functions in the places that I was serving. And I really, even if it didn't show up in my work, like, you know, as an officer, it was something I felt like I needed to know to understand my positionality in that place. And so it became really important for me to know that. And then over time, I realized like, oh, you know, education in these places is really different. The places where I've served are all kind of, or I should say the places where I've done degrees are under the British system. So both India and South Africa use the British education system, which is very independent, right? There's not a whole lot of classes. It's kind of like distance learning before distance learning, because they just expect you to do your own research and figure it out. And so that worked out really well side by side with my officer work, because I could get all the books and read it all and then do my essays on the weekends. And I really didn't have to sort of interrupt my workday to be able to do that. I think in terms of the gratification of the career, I certainly do not think I would still be in the Foreign Service if I didn't do those degrees. I think I would have gotten either bored or frustrated or sort of felt like I wasn't in touch if I didn't have that sort of research aim on the side. But I think my work in the service was really served by that, because I feel like I brought a lot of context and nuance, and I speak the languages of every place I've ever served. So I feel like I kind of came to our team, whether that be country team or the consular team or the management team, with insights that a lot of other people didn't have. So I think my career has really been enhanced by doing these things side by side.
I love how you have such a full picture of like so much stuff that's going on that not only enhances your career, but also gives you these creative outlets. And there's so much space to do and weave them into your career at the same time. And I'm curious, sort of, what's next for you on kind of your investment journey? And what's the best piece of advice you'd give to other Embassy Wealth listeners in terms of either investments or just really any piece of advice that you have for them?
Yeah, what's next? That's a good question. I feel like I call you every couple of months and then you tell me what I should do. For me, honestly, this year is all about revisiting my money story and figuring out why it is that I feel certain ways about money. And a lot of this has come up as I've moved up in my career, where I feel like, and I think you guys all know this, right? We have a base salary, but we go different places and we get different packages on top of that or not. And I feel like I'm kind of coming to this place where the places I want to serve and the places that I think would work well for my family, because I do have two little kids, feel like they might be a pay cut. Because I've always kind of gone up in terms of differential, like going from DC to Mozambique to Angola, it was a straight shot, right? To, you know, you can't get any higher than this, except if you go to PSP. I'm not going to do that because I've got smalls, right? So I think kind of coming back to a place where the cost of living and the differential might be different than where I was headed when I was single or just, two adults, feels like a recalibration in terms of my take-home pay. And I think for me, that's just really touched on my money story in ways that I didn't expect. So what does this say about the value of my time? What does this say about all the other benefits that maybe I'll use one day, but maybe I won't? So I feel like it's really gotten me to thinking about, you know, what do I really feel is the value of living overseas and the value of what I can offer my kids and the sort of legacy building. So this year is kind of just nose to the grindstone on thinking about how I have told myself what I can earn or told myself what the maxes were for what I should charge and why I feel that way. And then I guess in terms of Foreign Service folk, I think you just have to understand that we all can monetize all of our hobbies. I think there's always a way. Like, I mean, Americans are hustlers, right? Like, I think at our heart, like we can sell milk to a cow, right? Like, we have a sort of, you know, commercial capitalist part of us that I feel like in many ways, like Foreign Service people are taught that you shouldn't lean into it. You shouldn't lean into that inclination to be an entrepreneur. You shouldn't lean into that inclination to be an investor outside of your TSP. I think in many ways that's COVID has brought that out, but also maybe just this generation has brought out the necessity to stay on top of all of the ways that you can create different streams of income for yourself and create wealth for yourself. And it doesn't have to be in you know, in contestation with your career. You can show up 100% as a stellar officer and still be, you know, an artist who sells your work, right? Who doesn't devalue the things that you do outside of the State Department. So I would just encourage people to really just use all of their gifts and to really consider where they're muting those opportunities and why they're doing it, right? Do you feel like it's because, you know, it's somehow going to put you in a space where you may or may not show up as people, I don't know how to even put it, you know, do you feel like there might be some kind of a conflict with work? If that's the case, is that genuine? Like, is that real? And I say that a lot of times to people who are thinking about buying property, right? They're like, oh, well, I'm serving in, I don't know, Greece, and I want to buy a house in Italy, but I don't know the Foreign Service life. I'm like, well, I think you should investigate that, right? You know, look into it. Is that really a roadblock, or is it an imagined problem? And so I think we definitely have to understand that a lot of our problems are imagined problems, and that if we really wanted to do it, we could. And last, I would say, you know, the Foreign Service lifestyle is amazing. You know, it offers so many benefits, but I think you also have to know when the lifestyle is the golden handcuff, or when it creates cycles of debt or spending that aren't sustainable, right? So for example, when I was in India, I have lots of jewelry that I never wear from that tour, because it was kind of like, you know, you have a rough day on the line and you go to the jewelry store and you buy yourself earrings and you have no place to wear them, but you're going to wear them on, you know, the consular line or something. I don't know. And I just realized, like, you know, I'm trying to keep up with people who are like, you know, 40 and 50 when I'm 25 or 26, right? Like, I'm trying to spend the way that they spend. I'm trying to, because we're on the consular line together, I feel like we should be in the same place. And I think you just have to know, like, everybody in this career starts, sure, we have the same salary when we start, but like, people are starting from different places. For some people, this is a second career, a third career, even, you know, for some people, this is like their first job out of college. And I think, you know, the keeping up with the Joneses is a little difficult in the Foreign Service to understand, but it still happens. And so you have to make sure that you're not spending in comparison to other people where you're really not at that space, and that you need to secure your own foundation with, you know, maxing out your TSP or saving properly or paying down your student loans. And all those things, I think, are still fundamental to the way that Foreign Service officers should consider their money. But it can be hard to see that when you're abroad, and you may not really see those different fault lines until maybe a tour in and you think, oh my God, I got to clean that up. But there's always time.
Thank you so much. I just love your approach to everything. And you're incredibly holistic about your approach to your career, but then also about your own development outside of your career. I really think our listeners enjoyed hearing your story. And thank you for taking the time to join
us. Thank you so much for having me. It's been interesting to even hear myself say these things out loud. So thank you for having me on the show. And I hope I could have helped and inspired somebody to do something that they've been considering for a long time as a hobby, and think about that more seriously.
If you like this episode and want more, make sure to give us 5 stars on the podcast player of your choice. And after that, check out our Facebook page. From there, you can learn about our other episodes, connect with our guests, and of course, share your own ideas for success. We'll see you next time.